Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino. Elizabeth is the CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, a leading multimedia provider of lifestyle content. The Best Ever You Network, helping you live your life to the fullest. It's where you'll find inspirational and encouraging stories, advice, and information with our radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. Real people, real advice, real places, real products and businesses, real life stories, and more, including real celebrity life. Be your best and keep it real, confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You. Now, here's your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino.
Okay, well, my name doesn't compare to the name we've got on. We have the legendary and iconic Ed Asner with us today. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Fine, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much, and I can't thank you enough for being with us. We're gonna have a half hour show today, everyone. I just want for those of you listening who are planning on the hour, we're gonna cut it off at a half an hour. But please go into the chat room, and if you have questions for Ed, please type them out. I will ask them to him live on air. And it almost feels like you hardly need an introduction. I mean, it's just it's just a pleasure for you to be here. With us. But I have a quote from you, and I wanted to start off the show. It says, "We pass this way once, and how we behave along the way is who we turn out to have been all along." I'm curious with that quote. Who have you turned out to be?
Well, far more successful than I ever thought I would be. It all comes as I keep finding that pony in the tent. And I'm just surprised.
Are you really?
This is not to say that I don't get bitter. I've had too much of that. But when I'm rational, I look at what I've been given, and I'm extremely happy by it.
Yeah. You just turned 82. On November 15th, is that correct?
Correct.
Happy birthday.
You're late.
I know, I'm late. I saw you on Twitter, and I'm like, oh, darn it, I missed saying happy birthday to you. I noticed you're not retired at all, and I think your audiences are thrilled that you're not retired or anything. Do you ever plan to retire or anything like that?
I don't know how to spell it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know.
I'm only good for acting, so if I can't act, then what sense is there in life?
Yeah. Did you always, when you were a kid, did you know this was what you were going to do?
No. I was romantic. I was always escaping in my mind and in my dreams, but I never thought of acting as a means of achieving it.
Really? I noticed that you you played some football.
In high
Is that
school?
Right? Yeah. Will you tell us a little bit about that? Now, that comes from my son. I have four boys. They're 10, 12, 14, and 16, and my son was helping me research you, and so I put the kids on a mission to tell me about Ed Asner. And my son said he was a football player. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Repeat the question, would you?
Well, my son noticed when they were helping me research you, he noticed that you were a football player and he plays football, and he just wanted you to talk a little bit about football in high school and if that meant anything, sports meant anything to you when you were younger.
It meant a great deal. I came from a family. Both my brothers were athletes of sorts, and when I came along, I found myself going to Hebrew school, which they didn't have to do, so that after I finished school, a normal school day, I'd have to take a streetcar and go down to the temple and take some more lessons, so that I was not able to get out and play the sports and learn the sports that my peers were doing. so I felt deprived in that sense. And by the time I got into high school, Hebrew school was over, and I was bar mitzvahed and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I eagerly wanted to put myself into the pit to be a jock like my peers.
Yeah.
And so I tried out for the freshman football team, and grossly inefficient. I ended up being a lineman, a tackle,
mm-hmm.
and did not have the grace and the agility that a normal athletic growing up would have provided me. So I learned. I was a poor student, each year I would go out to the team and end up playing some and learning some.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, in my senior year, I found myself a first-string tackle.
Oh, that's neat. What a great story that is. Yeah, my son did that. He tried out and didn't make it, actually, and then tried out again and made it this year. Yeah, oh, that's a blow, too. He cried in his – oh, I better not say that. He was in his room for 2 days. I don't know whether he was crying or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then this year we went to the football banquet the other night, and he got his award and everything like that, so it was really cool. Yeah, and, you know, we talked a little bit that you definitely don't know how to spell retired, which is excellent because I don't know how to spell it either. I'm never retiring either. But one of the things that you've been doing is this one man show.
You're retired from having boys, though, haven't you?
I am. Oh, yes. I am done. I am done having children, but they are the best kids. Oh, I notice you have a bunch of kids, too. I love my kids so much. They're just, kids are what it's all about, isn't it? They're just amazing. Yeah. They are. Do you want to talk about kids first, or do you want to talk maybe about this one man show? Because you've got this, it's almost like a sensation going around the country, this one-man show with you as FDR. And for those who haven't had the privilege of seeing this show, I was wondering if you could tell people about it. You've been touring for quite a while now. Are you still touring?
Yeah, I'm in my third year now.
Yeah.
In 90 cities so far.
Wow.
And it started out, I was one of the celebrity actors chosen by Philip Langner for the Theater at Sea Cruises, whereby you'd do works that you were eager to do for the passengers,
mm-hmm.
Or you'd take on an assignment handed out by the producers to do a reading of a play or whatever. On this particular cruise I was on, I had nothing prepared and didn't know what I was going to do. And Philip came forward with the idea of doing a reading of Dori Sherry's follow-up to Sunrise at Campobello, which is the play we now do called FDR, which takes FDR from the moment his polio hit him until his death. The reading went well, and you know, it was okay. And then shortly after the cruise, Philip suggested the idea that maybe we ought to try taking it out of the one-man show.
Yeah.
And I said, fine. I didn't care what it was, but the challenge of accomplishing a one-man show was what intrigued me, to see if I could do it. And so after long preparation, we launched it. On the American City Circuit, and we're now here, and I'm delighted it happened.
Yeah, it's. I know you. I'm in Portland, Maine, and I know you made a stop here too. But it sounds like this is not only personal but professional, because it sounds like you really admire FDR.
I heard the news when I was about 15 of his death, and the way it hit me at the time, it was as if God the Father had died,
yeah.
The only president I had ever known. And I started out admiring him from that uninformed status, of this singular president that I knew none other. And from that time on, I've done prodigious reading on FDR, and I idolize him now more than ever.
Yeah, he's my favorite president too. So yeah. we have that. Yeah, I've always been just fascinated with him, and I don't quite know why. So it's pretty special to hear you talk about him, because I don't know if the kids these days get their full dose of FDR like we did when we were kids.
Well, the Republicans have been very busy trying to tear down everything he built up.
Yeah,
ever since his existence, and I think that he will survive any and all of their onslaughts.
Yeah, he was the only, you know, there's a lot of younger listeners too who don't know everything about FDR, and I don't know if any of us really do, but he had 4 terms as president,
yeah.
And that's
yeah.
when there were no term limits. That's fascinating, and my husband called him a casualty of World War II that's never been counted, because, you know, he wondered if that maybe just took such a toll on his health and a strain.
Oh,
would you? Yeah. What's the in researching? Is there a lot of research on your end that goes into playing a character like, you know, playing a president like that and being in a show like that? Because that's, if I understand it right, it's you and you alone up on stage for an hour or more. It's kind of like doing a radio show for an hour by yourself in a way, but you're really there by yourself. Is that something that's really difficult to do?
Well, I can say that I spent months preparing for the role, and my knowledge was insufficient, but I've continued to study the man with whatever biographies I can lay my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a great trip, and the amazing thing is that with all of my reading, his star has not been blemished.
Mm-hmm.
I see the shortcomings, the faults, the failures, but it makes him even stronger and brighter in my eyes than before I began the research.
Yeah. Would you ever do something like write a book on him yourself?
No.
No, okay.
I'm not a book writer.
Yeah, I noticed that. As we were looking into everything, I noticed that you hadn't, you're not a book writer, are you? I was looking, like, I wonder if he's written any books or anything, but no. So everybody knows you for being, you know, you've been asked this question a million times, but I'm going there anyway, because it's, everybody knows you for being Lou Grant on Mary Tyler Moore Show. And I wondered if, did you guys ever sit around in a group ever and debate who was really the funniest of that cast?
Did I say that again? Did what?
I wondered if you ever sat around in a group and debated just who was the funniest or most talented in that cast. That's just a fascinating cast of people.
Well, Mary was the phenomenon. She was the princess fairy who was the linchpin for all of these nutcases revolved around her. She was essential to the show. She was, as I say, our linchpin.
Yeah.
She wasn't the funniest necessarily, but she set up the program, the ability for us to be the nutcases that we were.
Yeah.
And it was a perfect platform to do our shenanigans. In terms of the funniest, I don't think anybody can compare to Ted Knight.
Oh yeah, he was hilarious, wasn't he?
He was
absolutely. I was watching last night. I was watching a bloopers reel. And I was watching him walk in and out of a door with a hat thing or something, and you know, I didn't get, you know, I was born in 1969, so it's not like I have every one of these shows memorized or anything like that, but there's nothing on TV like this, really. Or do you think there is?
No. I have to admit that the last good comedy I watched, I don't watch much TV, was Seinfeld. I got a great delight out of Seinfeld.
Yeah,
but and it's a very different case. I compare Mary Tyler Moore and Seinfeld to Mary, the Mary show being five wonderfully loving people of each other in spite of their faults. That includes Ted. And giving and generous and open-hearted, as opposed to Seinfeld, which showed these four amoral people who were seeking their creature comforts to the nth degree and rationalizing it all the way through and delightfully amusing us by their spitting in the eye of appropriateness.
Yeah. Yeah, I search for something like this on TV, and I just don't see it. So I'm one of those who doesn't watch too much TV either, because it has to kind of hold up to this. This is kind of my standard.
Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing I noticed that most everybody that's involved with the show is still really actively working. You know, for example, Betty White, she's
become a tiger.
Hilarious. Yeah. Betty White's my idol, just so you know.
She's the monster that ate Tokyo.
Do you guys still hang out at all? Do you see each other? Do you know you have?
Well, Mary is in New York,
and the longest
time she lived outside the city, so it was difficult to maintain much contact with her. I see Valerie from time to time. Both of us have been active in the union in the past few years. So I see her and got to admire her tremendously as Tallulah Bankhead. Gavin has slowed down. He may be living in the desert for all I know. I'm not sure. But he looks in good shape. And I hope and pray that he'll be with us for a long time. Ted is gone.
Yeah.
Georgia is constantly running around the country doing dinner theater shows and has been very successful at that. But the standout, of course, is Ms. White.
That's a funny thing. Will you ever host Saturday Night, or have you ever hosted Saturday Night Live? I was curious.
Yeah, I did once.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, I was looking for it. And would you ever go back now and do Saturday Night Live now?
Oh, sure.
Oh, they need you on Saturday Night Live. So Saturday Night Live, I know you're probably not listening, but if you are, word out, Ed Asner needs to be back on. I love that. And I was looking at, and we're going to talk politics in a minute here, but in researching you, and you know, and I don't know everything about you, of course, but there was this one thing. I was thinking this too. I'm like, I wonder what impresses him, because you know you're brilliant and you've done so many things and everything. But I noticed there was actually a segment on the Tonight Show called "Does This Impress Ed Asner?"
Yeah,
really. Because I was thinking, I wonder what I say to be, you know, to do this radio show today so well, and I came across that, and I just, what was that? Is that, you must have the best sense of humor.
Well, it was pretty stupid at times.
Yeah.
And I had to go along with the gags, but there were occasional bright moments that I, had a great deal of fun doing, and it was nice. You always take pleasure in having these moments whereby you pop up on TV and show people that you're still alive.
I don't think that. I'm impressed that you have such a good sense of humor. I mean, really, really, and truly, you know, it's just funny, and it shows that you're not just so serious, because you know you're the president of the screen. You know, you were the president of the Screen Actors Guild. I mean, that's huge. And what, for somebody who doesn't know exactly what that is, what does that mean? It feels like a political role almost in Hollywood.
Well, it does have its political side to it. I came in as a child in terms of political daring do and political capability. I learned on the job, and thank God I had a lot of wonderful people around who advised me sufficiently and adequately. So they learned on the job. But it was a stormy time. A stormy time because of my involvement in El Salvador. A stormy time because at the time SAG, before he even took office, had decided to bring in the remainder of the extras union, whose union had collapsed. Now, most extras were covered already or had SAG, Screen Actors Guild, cards already. But there were a number who had no SAG card and no longer had a union representing them as extras, about 1,500. So the union elected to absorb them. It created a storm within the union. Charlton Heston and other actors of that ilk thought it would contaminate the union. The stuntmen and day players felt it was a threat to bring in these new pounds of flesh to take their jobs, so they opposed it. And we, in our generosity, created a referendum so that the members of the union could vote on it. But we really bent over backwards because we needed a two-thirds plurality. We never got there. We had two referendums, and we lost both. Eventually, after I left office, the union found a means of taking in these extras, so it became a windstorm is what it ended up being. But it divided the union somewhat at the time.
With all of your politics that you're involved with right now, you're a well-known political activist. Was that being the president of the Screen Actors Guild the incipient point for, the platform of political activism, or was it something else?
What?
Sorry, I said the incipient point. Was it what launched your career with political activism?
The birth of my political activism. I had already become somewhat involved politically, particularly with the tyrannicide that existed in Latin America and the death squads that roamed El Salvador, Guatemala, places that we looked the other way on or merely supplied the weaponry and financing to the generals who ran those countries. And I spoke out against it and was deemed a communist because of my attitude. And there was an effort to disallow me in the entertainment field because of that.
Well, and how do you overcome something like that? What do you do when something like that happens to you? I mean, obviously you're doing just fine all along, but when something like that happens to you, what do you do?
Well,
or what did you do?
CBS eventually canceled the show because of the controversy.
Yep.
Although you'll always find loudmouths who try to claim otherwise.
Right.
The show was canceled, and from the appearance of things, it looked like I might not be invited to appear on any other shows after that. There was something of a blacklist that went on against me.
Mm-hmm.
But time, I think, had proved me right, and a lot of people realize it. I survived the blacklist. As my agent said, I figured that I would disappear into that gentle good night when the controversy arose. And when my agent said that the fact that every time an attack was launched against me, that I responded in kind and stood as tall as I could, which is not tall, and I answered blow for blow, he thinks that my combativeness is what kept me alive, and I survived that partial blacklist.
Yeah. Now, my dad has a question for you. Isn't that neat?
How
my
is
dad,
he?
I think he might be actually home for Thanksgiving. It's been a long 40 days, and he's been in the ICU in Burnsville, Minnesota now for a really long time, so we thank everyone there for keeping him alive. very misfortune there. But he wants to know, before I went on the phone.
I have my own case against doctors, so I totally understand and sympathize.
Yeah, thank you, because, you know, he's 68 and it shouldn't have happened to him. It was a missed clamped artery during a kidney cancer surgery, which we already had talked about that. But just a real unfortunate to have somebody have to struggle to keep their life like that. But
yeah.
He says, you cover the outer limits of our political spectrum. How difficult is it for your message to be heard by the folks in the middle?
Oh, it's quite, the setup is that when an actor takes a position that departs from the middle, he automatically threatens audience attention or acceptance because he's departed from the middle. A producer will have to change his shorts if he finds an actor engaging in political speechifying or identifying. And this is beyond Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, what have you. So it's automatic that when you espouse certain political views, perhaps half of your audience don't agree with those views. And a large portion of that, 50%, will say, to hell with him, I'm not going to turn him on. He's a commie or he's a fascist. Mm-hmm. So it is a tricky bit of ground to trod. And many actors won't do it and prefer to remain anonymous in terms of their political identification. I think a good case in point would be Meryl Streep, who came out speaking against Alar, which is what they used to coat apples with, and they still do.
Yeah.
And there was such an outburst against her, I don't think we've seen Meryl Streep identify with any particular cause since then.
Yeah, but for example, it seems like that's what makes us. It makes
absurd, but you can't treat actors who depend on people to watch and listen to them as being regular Joes. You've got advertisers who will object to what the client is postulating. So I guess it occurs in every business. That's why most businessmen really don't make a big parade of who they're voting for, who they're supporting. Unless it's the very rich, like the Koch brothers, who try to control politics with their billions.
Yeah, it definitely seems like you can alienate people if you say the wrong thing or whatever. But you know, again, it is what it is. Do you think? So our show. I'm wondering, is there any way you could hang with us for just a little bit more, maybe 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. Our focus of our show is on helping people be their best. And I'm not a political activist or anything like that, but I do want to know, because it's such a big part of your life, how do you think your messages help people or the country or the people of the country or the country itself be their best?
Well, what I've always regarded myself, because I'm an actor, because I am in that elevation above sea level in terms of name identification, I've always regarded myself as a catalyst, not to do the research, to do the hard work of uncovering the truth and pursuing the truth. But once having been given the truth, when I speak it, people say, What'd he say? And they will listen and may like it or they may loathe it. So that's the purpose I serve in advertising truths when I can find them.
Yeah. We have a question from a listener, and they say, given your illustrious career and accomplishments, What does professionalism mean to you, and how do you carry that and civility into your workplace?
Professionalism is merely the practice of perfecting the principles of what you do, of sharpening them, of learning them. The learning process never stops. Every time you work with a monster of an audience, you're finding new things to get to the navel of that audience, to the heart or to the mind of that audience. And it's never a completed process. You're always working on your PhD. I find this, I did a show of FDR 2 days ago, and I employed new means of dealing with a moment of handling it, or perhaps even turning it into a laugh where none existed before. And that's I would say professionalism is exceeding prodigiousness.
Yeah, I totally agree. That came from our civility. We have a civility CEO on Best Ever You, and all she does is help our audience with professionalism, etiquette, and civility. And so that's Sue Jakes who asked that question, and thank you, Sue, for that.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, and so I have two more things that I was hoping that we could talk to you about before you have to go. And one of them was your children, and we have shows that we frequently do on Best Ever You to help our audience with autism. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about autism and autism speaks. You have a son who's a high, what did they call it, a high functioning? High functioning, and then you have a grandson. I saw an interview with him on, and so I was hoping maybe you could just touch on that, because I know Areva Martin is very involved with us on Best Ever You with autism.
Well, the main objective in terms of autism is acquainting the world with what autism is, and I lay particular emphasis on the authorities, the police departments, who may find a kid who's autistic, who is not behaving appropriately socially, or may be combative verbally socially, and rather than reason with him or be patient with him, it's possible they'll whack him. And the education of the authorities, excuse me, the education of authorities in terms of what kind of kids these are, what they're capable of, that they're not blithering idiots. Many of them are geniuses.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Brilliance comes from autism.
Yeah. And that is, first of all, to educate the public. That's one of the... My other son is conducting a radio show on Saturday afternoons from 3 to 5, I think. And I'm not sure what radio network they're on now, but it deals primarily with autism. And all of the people who are somehow tied in now with autism, this is all a totally new area of discovery, of learning and associating, while we search for how we can improve the debilitating asocial factors of autism.
Yeah.
You have your various levels. Some are totally incomprehensible. Others are high functioning. My son had a shadow teacher all through middle school, and then launched into high school, and now he's in his third year of college in the East. Hang on one second.
No problem. we're going to cover while Ed has to hang on, because I know we are totally running over on time here. He said he could only do a half an hour, so we're on borrowed time at this point. So yeah, I was just letting people know.
All right, well let me just open that door and I'll take him.
No problem. Yeah, we're definitely on borrowed time here with Ed. So hang on, everybody, and all our listeners, because we really appreciate him hanging on the phone with us a while here. So I love it. I'm on the radio. Be quiet. It's cute. So it's nice to have a few extra moments here. Yeah, thank you. I covered because we're on your borrowed time. So thank you so much. Yeah. So we were talking about autism and how he's in college now. And basically your message is a little TLC for all the people and all the children who have autism. You know,
well,
no understanding
they
patients
have
and TLC.
I've often thought that the world would be a better place if everybody was autistic because they basically are nonviolent. If they're violent, then it's probably violence against themselves.
Yeah.
And they have so much to teach us just in terms of patience. And one of the things that our lives are confronted with in this day is less and less patience. So the 30-second soundbite is being reduced to 15 seconds. And if we could stop and smell not the flowers, but the autists,
mm-hmm.
we might be better off.
Yeah.
Take a moment to think.
Are you active in finding any kind of cures or things like that? And I don't have children with autism, but I have lots of friends who have children with autism, and the moms are frantic for a cure or a reason.
Well, there probably will never be a cure because it's probably a blockage or a rearrangement within the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know whether... it supposedly is not genetic, although I have a son and a grandson who has it, but in different degrees. Environment is considered by some. There was this big drive to outlaw the triple shots, feeling that it induced autism. I think that's been disproven, particularly since the British researcher who spoke about it has been disallowed. It is a problem that we have to realize exists. Environment may have something to do with it, affect it, but we have to play with the cards we've been dealt.
Yeah, I noticed two things seem to be environmental these days, and one seems to, or perhaps be environmental is probably a better way to say that, would be autism and food allergies. And I'm a food allergy sufferer. I have anaphylaxis to peanuts and tree nuts and fish and shellfish and all sorts of food allergies. And I know a lot of the people with autism seem to have food sensitivities as well. There seems to be some crossover there as well. So, you know, who knows what the solution will be or if there ever will be one. But I just wanted to thank you because I know we have some listeners in there who are specifically tuned in to hear you talk about that. And then just one more thing before we go. I know I keep saying that, but it's really exciting to be able to talk to you.
It's such a pleasure.
And maybe you could be on again. You do so many things that I don't know if people know that you do all these things. And you're the voice of a ton of different characters. I thought that was the neatest thing. I never knew half of these things about you. So we know Up. We know you're that guy from Up. but what are some – you're the voice of some video games.
Yeah, well, those are associated with Up. I did something with the Star Wars video game, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what others I've done in terms of video games, but I appear on the American Dad. I just did a voice on,
mm-hmm.
and the Cleveland Show, and there are others, but I've done cartoon characters for a long time.
Yeah, Johnny Bravo, Family Guy, Grimm, Jumanji. Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of them. Is that fun for you? Is that just fun, or is that
it's acting.
So
it's
anything acting is fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that how do you discover that well, everybody knows your voice anyway. I suppose that's how, you know, you get to do those things. But how do you discover that you have that in you to be a voice of a character? Do you have to come up with voices of your own, or is it just your own voice? Or how do you get into that business? Because I think it's fascinating.
Well, I don't know how you necessarily get into it. But you start off and you read it the way you think it's supposed to be read, and then the director says, try it this way, try it that way, try it this way, try it that way, try it this way, try it that way. And in the course of it, you lose your voice, but you're finding new avenues of outlet.
Yeah.
And I naturally, when I first started, when I was a kid, I wanted to emulate my brother's voice as much as possible. He had a very sexy voice. So whenever his girlfriends called, I tried to sound like him.
That's a great one.
And then, you know, I got quite close to it, and that started the lower register, mature,
of the career, yes.
Debonair, suave, dashing, and so playing around with that. I loved to sing at the time. Tried to find the key most of the time. So that expands your voice, and I, as you know, I have an ample chest and a certain amount of lung power, so that enables me to investigate. For instance, they even once said that a basso friend of Caruso's lost his voice. So during an opera, whenever that basso had to sing, Caruso would turn up stage and do the basso part. Now, this is a tenor. And I guess he got away with it.
Oh, yeah. So what haven't you done that you still want to do?
You.
That's funny.
What do I want to do?
Yeah. What haven't you done that
I am also a strange actor in that respect. I never say, oh, I got to do my Lear. I got to do my Willie Loman. I never want, because I was so happy with the roles that I was given. It satisfied me. I established them, and I didn't have to go through the Sturm und Drang of getting them done. Now, maybe it made me a lazy actor, but not pursuing my particular great roles. But I like who I am.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I operate, too. I just kind of like being me, and whatever comes my way, comes my way. So it's this is a treat in my life, though. I hope you know that. It's this is really just one of those moments. You know, my parents are listening. It's just really neat to be able to talk to you. And you stayed on the phone. We almost made the full hour, actually.
Yeah, I'm going to remember you for that,
though.
Sister.
Yeah,
you squeezed it out of me, didn't you?
it's a moment. So, but when one more thing, what is where can you're doing FDR? So, is there a spot where people can go? And if not, I'll find it and put it on Best Ever You Anywhere, so people can see where you're going to be. Is there a place where that's announced?
I'm with the Wynwood Booking Agency.
Okay, I'll find it.
Yeah.
Okay, are you coming back to Maine?
I would love to. I love Maine.
Come on, come back to Maine. Fill the Merrill Auditorium.
I think so goes the nation, so I want to go.
Yeah, exactly, Lisbon Falls.
all right.
All right, well, thank you so much for being with
Give
me.
Give your father my best.
Yeah, oh, thank you so much. Yeah, he'll really appreciate that because... he's been really ill, so all of us kids, there's 11 of us kids, too, so it's been brutal.
God.
Yeah, I'm right in the middle of all of it.
that was a busy Goomba, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a whole book that needs to get written, actually.
Yeah.
the middle of 11 kids. So, all right, well, thank you so much, and I appreciate you being with us today, and I hope that you will visit us again soon, because it's been a real treat, and I'm sure everybody listening just thoroughly enjoyed the interview. So have a wonderful day, and happy birthday. Happy, happy, happy birthday.
Belatedly.
I will never miss it again.
You'll know better next year.
I will. All right. Thank you so much. All right, take care.
Lots of love.
You too. Bye.
Bye.